Hi, thank you for coming. I'm Derek Sherman from Calvin College, but I'm Canadian. I'm living in the States, but I am a proud Canadian. I'm going to be speaking on discerning a Christian response to AI, which I must confess is basically coming largely out of a call for papers that we had in the Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith on a special issue for AI. Which I encourage everyone who's so inclined to submit papers to. And I'll close with some details about that again. But this is based in part on that call. So basically starting with the movie WALL-E. I like the movie WALL-E. It's a kind of parable for technology and for how we respond as humans. You know, it's the story of I assume most of you have seen it, but basically it's a dystopian kind of world where humans are kind of passively being, you know, shuttled about on reclining easy boy chairs, consuming, you know, large beverages, entertained by personal screens. They become a shadow of what the image of God was intended for them, I would say. And at the climax of the movie, the captain, who's barely able to walk, waddles over to the control panel to seize back control from the automated system, which has been basically running everything. And I think that this movie is a kind of parable for human responsibility and how we respond with technology. Are we going to take control? Or are we going to take responsibility? And in the words of Stephen Garber, knowing what we know, what are we going to do? It has a happy ending, by the way, WALL-E, if you haven't seen it. AI history. So it's been covered in a previous talk by Martin, and so I won't spend too much time on this, but Alan Turing's name, among others, McCarthy, Martin Minsky, and others are all pioneers in artificial intelligence. The Dartmouth proposal early on made the premise that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. That was the presupposition in the early days. Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert published a very influential book called Perceptrons, where they talked about things related to basically simulating crudely a human neuron. And what they wrote here was, perceptrons have widely been publicized as pattern recognition or learning machines, and as such have been discussed in large number of books, journal articles, and voluminous reports. Most of this writing is without scientific value. This was their prediction in the early days when this book was written. And basically, it sort of preceded one of the winters in AI, where people kind of thought, nah, this doesn't really work. It's not going to be very promising. And so through the 1970s, there was one AI winter. There's been multiple AI winters. But then interest was reignited in the 1980s. There were breakthrough papers about how using backpropagation and gradient descent algorithms and so on to kind of tune these weights, how effective those were to actually getting some really good results. And then more recently, what was described earlier, the deep learning methods that we've seen with some of the recent news. And so what we've seen is some remarkable progress. And this has been talked about partially already, so I will I'll only spend a bit of time on this slide. But the AlphaGo, which was mentioned in a previous presentation, AI techniques basically using deep learning to make some really, really remarkable strides. And, you know, being able, as was mentioned, I guess Martin's lab is involved in using medical imaging and AI and so on, and medical applications of deep learning. And as he mentioned, there are some areas, niche areas, where deep learning algorithms actually outperform human doctors. But we've seen in other places, Go, autonomous vehicles, and TensorFlow, which is like this open source kit you can get from Google, and you can basically run your own, even without really understanding all the minutiae of AI, you can download these libraries, these open source libraries now, and if you've got a nice CUDA card, a nice GPU card in your computer, you can actually do a lot of nifty work with some of these libraries. And of course, this has kind of led to a recent sort of flurry of different books and publications about AI. A lot of people thinking about what are the implications going to be about this technology as it finds its way into our daily lives. several of these books have actually been reviewed in the Perspectives for Science and Christian Faith, the flagship journal of the ASA and CSCA. And let me put in a really quick plug. If you are so inclined and you would like to read books and do book reviews, please come talk to me afterwards. We're always looking for good, competent book reviewers for the Perspectives Journal, also from Canada. So please talk to me. But yeah, many of these books have taken a look at this, the rise of the robots, the second machine age, the rise of artificial intelligence, the end of work. All of these topics that sort of come out of some of the fears and hopes that are related to artificial intelligence. And what you see is that generally these sort of fall into, this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but an optimistic and a pessimistic kind of view of the future. The optimistic one is basically an illustration of what is termed technicism. And technicism is basically the secularized faith in technology as savior of the human condition, that by our own bootstraps, eventually we'll sort things out, we'll solve the problems of that surround us, we'll be able to usher in our own age of our own utopian age. This is a recent book that was published, which I find quite striking in terms of the claim that it makes in its subtitle. This book, Infinite Progress, this image is taken from this website, has the subtitle, How the Internet and Technology Will End Ignorance, Disease, Poverty, Hunger, and War. I mean, this is biblical language, right? This is a post-millennial kind of view of using technology to usher in the new heavens and the new earth. And I you see this in some of this literature, of course, not in all literature, but this is not new, right? This goes back to Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel, where we see humankind, you know, using their own wits to build a name for themselves and to build a bridge between heaven and earth by their own wits. And how God foiled that early on. Of course, as Christians, we believe that any time that we replace a trust in the Creator with something in creation, that's idolatry. And of course, Jesus is the only bridge between heaven and earth. And some people have gone so far with this that you perhaps have heard of this in the news, but there is now a church of AI. Maybe some of you have heard of this, right? It's led by Anthony Levandowski, who's a former Google and Uber engineer. He's basically set up an organization to, quote, develop and promote the realization of a Godhead based on artificial intelligence, unquote. And, he goes on, through understanding and worship of the Godhead, to contribute to the betterment of society. All right? And there's some other transhumanists who have joined him, and basically they're suggesting that this new AI deity will actually, quote, exist and hopefully will do things for us. And they actually have their own gospel. It's called the Manual. They're talking about public worship ceremonies and even a physical place of worship. Here the idolatry becomes very, very clear. A basic trust in technology. And in fact, this has come up in this conference as well, the notion that one day, through technology, we will even be able to solve the problem of death, right? This notion promoted by people like Ray Kurzweil, who are brilliant engineers, that we will one day be able to download our brains into a computer and live forever. Quoting David Pierce here, if we want to live in paradise, we'll have to engineer it ourselves, right? So the idea is that, you know, there's certain presuppositions that you need to hold in order for this to make any sense. And these philosophical presuppositions basically state that to be human is basically to emulate the electrochemical reactions in the brain. And as long as we can do that accurately enough in a computer of sufficient complexity and the neuroscientists can reverse engineer the brain, basically the physicalist presuppositions about what it means to be human, basically those ideas lead to the logical conclusion that one day we will be able to live forever. When I look at this, I think of Psalm 115, right? Psalm 115 states that the makers of idols will become like them. And I think in this case, right, when you download your brain into a computer, you're a computer, right? And I think that this is sadly mistaken. Some people have coined this the rapture of the geeks. And of course, we can see this in other places too. Maybe some of you are familiar with Wolfram's New Kind of Science, which is a fascinating book, looking at patterns in creation and so on. As a computer scientist, it's an interesting read. But he talks about the principle of computational equivalence, where all processes can be viewed as computation. And he proceeds to show how, you know, automata and other algorithms can be used to reproduce all kinds of things in nature. Kevin Kelly, who is a writer for Wired magazine, has written an article called "God is the Machine," in which he explores the idea that everything is a simulation, right? The universe is a computer, and we are the killer app. And I think what you see in this these sort of books and these ideas is a kind of neo-Gnosticism. This came up in the transhumanism section as well, this idea that, you know, if we push this stuff to its logical conclusions, you know, our bodies really don't mean anything in the long run. They're kind of disposable. A new type of Gnosticism. Of course, there aren't just the optimists. There are the pessimists as well. One place where we've seen experts kind of rallying together is this open letter, which perhaps many of you have heard about, an open letter from researchers all around the world, signed by over 8,000 people now, about the risks of AI. Two very, very prominent names are included on this letter. Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, who wrote, "The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race, right? An existential threat to humanity." Elon Musk, who's an accomplished engineer and entrepreneur, has also joined in sounding his concerns. He wrote, "I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I had to guess at what the biggest existential threat is, it's probably that, even more than climate change." This is a letter that comes from people who are concerned about the downside of the direction of technology. And if we look at the artists, right? Sometimes the artists get there first. In fact, oftentimes the artists get there first. So you see in archetypes echoes of this kind of thing, right? Creatures trying to become like creators, or people trying to create living things, and the Frankenstein kind of narrative, right? Pinocchio, the Wizard of Oz, this quote from Frankenstein, right? "You are my creator, but I am your master. Obey," right? This is kind of, this comes at the climax. And HAL, more recent movies are all kind of very dark, dystopian kind of futures. Movies like Battlestar Galactica, Ex Machina, Westworld, Blade Runner, iRobot, and so on. Basically, these movies, the artists who have created them, are bringing up profound questions about what it means to be human, what it means to have free will, whether or how we are distinct from machines, and basically are beginning to try and think about these things. And I think as computer scientists, we also need to be more thoughtful about some of these philosophical underpinnings of the work that we do. So in reality, we are, as was mentioned, we are seeing a lot of rapid progress in this area. Perhaps the progress is faster than our current ability to kind of grapple with some of these ideas. I can remember being a graduate student. I was a graduate student at McMaster in the early 2000s in a PhD program there in the computer vision lab. And I remember if you asked me, and the people working in that lab, you know, will there ever be autonomous vehicles? We would have laughed at you, right? You know, there's no way, right? You know, computer vision is so fragile, and, you know, working in unstructured environments has so many problems. And you know, we were if you would have asked us, we all would have said, no, this is not going to be possible. And of course, you know, within a decade, Google had developed an autonomous vehicle, which it had successfully demonstrated. And so the question is now what happens? These autonomous vehicles are wonderful things to think about. Nifty technology combining all kinds of sensor fusion and computational learning and so on. But the question is, what happens when you can bolt on, an autonomous vehicle package for a couple thousand dollars to virtually any vehicle. What happens to the people? What happens to the people who, you know, have their job in, you know, driving-related fields? So one of the things, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but in the United States, what is the most common job for a man? Does anyone know what the most common job for a man is? Take a guess. Yeah?
Let's just say 5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes?
The most common job for a man.
Moderator. No, it's truck driver. Truck driver. And so if you look at the number of jobs that are predicted to be impacted by that, there's almost 3 million jobs that are potentially going to be impacted by that. If you look at all the different, and these are some various different reports that have been released at the end of Obama's tenure. They had an AI white paper that was produced, the Oxford Brookfield Institute and the Economic Development Institute have all released reports with predictions that are actually varying wildly. Here we see predictions about 9% job loss. Others have predicted as high as 47%. But what we're seeing is that there's a lot of legal, ethical, social implications that sort of fall out of this. This technology is not neutral. The whole idea about the end of work, what's going to happen, what's called the fourth industrial revolution or the second machine age, is going to bring all kinds of issues about what it means to build the kind of world we want to live in. And one of the things that, that people are predicting is there's going to be a huge sort of divergence. There's going to be a divergence in a spread in basically in financially. There's going to be bounty and spread. So the bounty is going to come from, you know, cheap goods that are going to be manufactured by automated machinery and artificial intelligence. But a lot of those sort of industries and so on are going to be controlled by relatively few people who are going to accumulate more wealth and more power. And this bounty and this spread is going to lead to rapid and to profound social changes in our society. So the question is, you know, what do we do with this? How do we respond also as Christians? One of the questions is this sort of a fait accompli? Is there anything that we can do, right? There is this stream in the philosophy of technology known as technological determinism, which basically says, you know what? Technology is an autonomous force beyond our control. There really is nothing that we can do. You know, the Mickey Mouse the Sorcerer's Apprentice sort of model of things running out of control. Or Star Trek, right? The Borg. Resistance is futile. So the question is, you know, is this something that that we can actually do something about? Or are we all on a bus headed for a destination that we really can't control? And Jacques Ellul talked about this in his book, The Technological Society, right? Just how technique is this totality of methods that are rationally arrived at having absolute efficiency for every field of human activity. So it's all about efficiency. You want to automate everything. And that will basically lead us to perhaps a place that we don't want to go, but it's unavoidable, some people would say. Neil Postman wrote about this as well in his book, Technopoly. So the question is, as Christians, I think we have to start off by asserting, already from Genesis 1, the notion that we have a responsibility, that things are not determined, but that we need to exercise both freedom and responsibility. In the words of Marshall McLuhan, there's no inevitability as long as there's willingness to contemplate what is happening. So here's six helpful questions that we might ask in the field of AI. And I've basically modified them from Neil Postman, who asked six questions about technology. The questions are, just very, very briefly, what is the problem to which AI is a solution? This gets to the idea of, should we even use AI in certain applications? Whose problem is AI solving? What problems will AI create even as it solves the problem? What people or institutions will be hurt by AI? What changes in language are being forced by AI? And what sort of people and institutions gain special economic and political power through AI? Basically, this gets at the idea that technology is not neutral. It has all kinds of other implications. And by asking these questions, you can begin to uncover some of the ways in which this technology is value-laden. So that this is, I've modified the questions, but they're based on questions that Neil Postman has asked. We shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us. So there are a whole bunch of really cool, nifty philosophical questions that arise, right? You see this in the science fiction movies as well, but AI brings up a lot of these questions. What is it, you know, the nature of being, which is the ontological questions, the question of knowing, epistemology, knowing what's right, you know, choosing what is right and good, ethics. What does it mean to be human, anthropology? And I would suggest that the questions that we need to start with philosophically are the ontological ones, right? Before we start talking about ethics, before we start talking about, you know, knowledge representation and all that sort of stuff, I think we need to ask the ontological questions. What does it mean to be human? Who we are? What are machines? How are we distinct? And I think when we answer the ontological questions, we can move forward to begin to answer the other ones. And I think the Christian worldview has a profound sort of theology about what it means to be human that can inform this. And I think even though it's embedded in deeply religious beliefs, that we can join the dialogue in the public square to discuss this. And there's a lot of other views, physicalism, materialism, and so on, that will come to very different conclusions about some of these things. I just want to put in a quick plug. One of the best books that I've read about physicalism and about sort of the philosophical presuppositions about what it means to be human and their implications for all kinds of areas like creativity, free will, environmental concerns, a whole bunch of things, is in this wonderful book called The Mind and the Machine by Matthew Dickerson, who's a respected computer science scientist from, I think, Middlebury College. And he basically looks at physicalism, and he says, okay, if we're going to use this as our starting point, what are the philosophical kind of consequences of sort of taking this idea to its logical conclusion? And he shows, like, how can you describe free will with physicalism? How can you describe, you know, what it means to be creative? You know, all kinds of things sort of fall out of it. So I would highly recommend this book. He's a Christian, Bible-believing Christian, and he's done a wonderful job in this book of, I think, working this out. This is a good resource. Christianity Today had an article about this just within the last year. Is AI a threat to Christianity? Some of the questions they were asking are things, will machines have the ability to pray? Would an AI have a soul? I found the questions not as interesting, to be honest with you, but these are stimulating questions. I think the bigger question is to go back and say, what does it mean to be human? And then to go and address some of these things, because some of these questions don't make any sense after you've sorted that out. The Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith, to put in another plug again, has published on this topic before. I think one great essay article was published by Russ Bjork from a college in Boston, Christian College, Gordon College. And he posed three questions in that article and worked with them. And I think these questions are still profoundly relevant and are still a good starting point as we begin the dialogue. You know, is there a conflict between AI and biblical teaching about the soul? Is there a conflict between AI and biblical teaching about being human and what it means to be made in the image of God? What does it have to say about personhood and all that sort of stuff? So I think this is a wonderful article to begin with as well. And many of the questions he posed there are still open questions, and there's much more words that need to be written down and spoken, I think, on this topic. And of course, once we've worked on the ontological questions, the ethical questions are manifold. You know, the trolley problem, what do we do with autonomous vehicles that have to make certain decisions? Lethal autonomous robots is a huge issue. Ron Arkin is a roboticist at Georgia Tech and a Christian who spoke at the Association of Christians for the Mathematical Sciences conference a while back and talked about his book, Governing Lethal Autonomous Behavior in Machines. And he's written about this. And again, it's this question, can we put ethics into an algorithm? Ought we to use machines to wage war? And what are the ethical implications of that? Related to this is the idea of child-minding robots, elder care robots, social robotics. Sherry Turkle, a social scientist from MIT, has been, I don't believe she's working from a Christian framework, but she has some very, very profound and thoughtful books on this topic, Alone Together, and so on, Reclaiming Conversation. You know, there's all kinds of questions. Sherry Hughes, how do we navigate privacy, transparency, justice? How do we show love and care for those whose jobs are threatened by automation? So I think what we need to look at is, what is normative AI? What are the norms that should govern AI? what are the things that we ought to do once we've answered the ontological questions about who we are and what role we ought to play and what role machines ought to play. And so some of the questions are basic questions like, what should machines not do, you know, even though they can't? Right? What are the activities that we as humans, driven by our deepest nature or the realities of daily life, will simply insist to be performed by other humans, regardless of what computers can do? To quote Jeffrey Colvin. And so that's on the one side. On the other side, well, you know, to kind of think, well, this AI is part of the possibilities in creation. What sort of new, wonderful things does AI open up that maybe we've never thought about before in areas like medicine, research, and environmental monitoring, humanitarian relief, search and rescue, assistive technologies for disabled people? I think there's all kinds of wonderful possibilities. Boutique manufacturing with 3D sort of printing, right? You know, there's all kinds of creative, wonderful worlds that get opened up. I don't have a lot of time, so I won't spend a lot of... I'll probably just skip over this. I got a few minutes, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. 26 minutes now, so...
Okay, I will just close with this. A dialogue has begun. And so these are all the different areas, different places. Some of these have been mentioned, where people in academia and other places are starting to talk about the ethical sides of AI and robotics. And there's no Christian kind of response to this that I've been able to discern outside of individual voices. And I would point to the Lausanne Covenant, which basically in 2010 brought together all kinds of evangelical Christian leaders to talk about contemporary issues. And this Cape Town commitment that came out of it said that there needs to be a call to action, and this specifically includes emerging technologies in AI having deep implications for the church and mission, particularly in relation to biblical truth, and what it means to be human. And so among the recommendations that come out of this Lausanne Covenant are to engage with new technologies, to speak into the shaping of public policy with a voice that is biblical and relevant. And I think that's what we need to do. And one way to start that, this is my last slide, is to consider submitting a paper to the Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith. August 31st, 2018 is the submission deadline. And there's a paper that you can find at this web address that sort of opens up a dialogue of questions. And I think challenges us to begin thinking about it, to begin the conversation. And that's a good place to start. So I'll leave it there.
So I have a question or a comment. Last week or so, there's been a lot of talk about Google being able to phone people and people not realizing that it's Google. Like, you know, AI is used in initiating a phone call and carrying on the conversation. Yes. And just today or yesterday, I saw a news story that Google has decided, or maybe it was told to, probably decided to be announcing the fact that, hello, I am a robot, I am calling you, rather than, because people are being, they're able to call people, and they wouldn't even know that they're speaking to a computer.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, I mean, that seems to be a good thing for them to do, to announce who they really are. When you call someone, that's what you do. It's a proper Christian norm. You call, hello, I'm Joe, I'm Arnold, I'm talking to you, Derek.
Yes.
I'm not pretending to be somebody who I'm not.
I think that this idea of norms needs to be guiding some of our work. I mean, the same has been with chatbots. Like, people have sort of, you know, been talking with machines unawares. One of the norms is listed here, and there's a link for these design norms in the paper that's cited in the call for papers and the perspectives. But one of the norms is transparency, right? We need to make sure that we're telling the truth, that we're above board. That comes with algorithms too. What's going on with algorithms behind the scenes that are making decisions about who gets a job and who doesn't get a job, and, you know, all kinds of areas where machines are beginning to make ethical decisions. There needs to be justice, and there needs to be transparency. A really important book on this topic is a book, Weapons of Math Destruction, which was also reviewed in the Perspectives of Science and Christian Faith. And not from a Christian perspective, but it's highlighting the fact that algorithms are not neutral. They're value-laden. You know, we think, oh, this is cold, sort of, you know, mathematical, that, you know, that we've got a utility function and we're just optimizing it. You know, how could that be value-laden? Well, it's highly calculated. It's profoundly valuated. And she looks at things like, you know, hiring decisions and loan applications. where existing biases in the training set get coded into these systems, and where there's profound injustice, you know, where things where it doesn't look obvious from the outset, but things like zip code become proxies for race and socioeconomic conditions and all these sorts of things. So transparency is one way. Justice, these are all important normative guidelines that can be helpful. Yeah.
So I guess for me, what really concerns about this whole thing is just the concentration of power on technology. So even now, you know, how many people in Google in a room can control what millions of people do with their time? They can control what they pay attention to, what they're thinking. So, but and then this gap just seems to be continuously increasing as we move forward with all this technology.
Yeah, that's question six. What organizations get special power? And you look at Facebook, right? I mean, recently with Zuckerberg testifying in front of Congress about, you know, the profound implications that social networking has on our social and political landscape and the responsibility that we need to take for that.
So do you think this trend that's already begun can be stopped or controlled? Like, because now you feel like these corporations are already more powerful than like some democratic governments. So.
Yeah. I'm hopeful. If people can be a little hopeful about climate change, I think we can be hopeful about this, with exercising human freedom and responsibility. I mean, even just the last week or so, the CEO of Microsoft, I don't know whether you caught this on the news, said, we shouldn't be asking what computers can do. We should be asking what computers should do. This was from Microsoft. And, you know, I think with some of the press that's come out of the Facebook hearings and so on, people are beginning to ask, you know, what kind of world are we building? And holding, and in fact, in the last couple of months, there was a New York Times article about Harvard and MIT and other tier one computer science schools saying, like, you know, we got to add ethics to our computer science program, right? I mean, there was this huge push to sort of add ethics. Now, my sort of critique of that is that you can't take, you know, a four-year computer science program, tack on one course on the end about ethics and expect to make people, you know, who are ethical. It requires a lot more. It requires a kind of anthropology that Christians can contribute to, but to talk about this, right? And there's existing things like the ACM Code of Ethics, the IEEE Code of Ethics, which, you know, are largely based on Judeo-Christian principles, where I think that we could begin a conversation in the public square, where we can use language and documents that are widely recognized, but where we could use our Christian insights to help guide the conversation. So, yeah.
And Eric, it's exactly that question I was thinking of, as these needs, obvious needs for a bit of Wild West, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're developing. And no guidance and pedagogy question was how do you actually do this?
Yeah.
Of course, there's a question of ethicalizing. So it's, I guess my question is this all AI going to be just kind of like engineering and a bit sort of self-reinforcing? If engineers are not ethical, then people get killed. Bridges fall down, buildings fall down, airplanes, things go very bad.
Yeah.
So is that going to be the sort of governor or break on this whole thing that's going to actually enforce morality or not?
Yeah, I don't know. I think what needs to change is that there is a kind of modus operandi in Silicon Valley, which is disruption. It's all about disruption, and then, you know, forging ahead with new stuff, and then figuring out the consequences later. And I think that's where responsibility needs to start. I mean, we need to agree on what values are going to form the kinds of technology that we're going to build. But I think that there needs to be, and I think regulation has a place in all of this. I think, you know, left to market forces, I think absolute efficiency is where a lot of activities will be pushed, and that's not the kind of world we want to live in. The pedagogical question is really interesting, and I've only begun to think about it, but there's a philosopher at Calvin College named Jamie Smith, and he has this idea that, well, it's not just his idea, but, you know, he's been promoting this notion that we're not primarily thinking things. He has this great example. He goes, you know, I was reading Wendell Berry, and I was going, yeah, I agree 100% with this. And then he realized he was reading Wendell Berry while he was standing in Costco eating a sausage. And so he's kind of going, well, how can I agree with Wendell Berry and be kind of moved, you know, and sit here and kind of consume a sausage, which is sort of the epitome of Wendell Berry's idea of, you know, what real food ought to be and so on, the local farming and so on. And he said, what it is, it's my heart, which is trained through habits and rituals, through kind of everyday liturgies that point me in a certain direction. And that's why my critique of this idea of slapping an ethics course on the end of a computer science program, this is the point, and I think this goes back to, you know, the Greeks and Aristotle, that, you know, behaviors are, you know, that you make someone virtuous through behavior, right, through practice, through, and I think part of what a Christian college can offer, at least in this area, is the whole idea of spiritual formation and forming, you know, the whole person, right? We're not just downloading a bunch of technical skills to so people can get jobs, but we're trying to create a certain kind of person, right? And
I just want to follow that. That engineering model of, you know, government regulated right to title, right to practice, which brings some order out of these things. But it seems like this is an area where the very construction of the World Wide Web, for instance, maybe doesn't lend itself to looking at the general public, to be included. But, you know, even they can't trace this guy, they can't go,
yeah,
he's doing bad stuff, they can't actually find him. Well, what kind of a world is that?
Yeah, some of the architecture.
Is there a real?
Yeah, adding ethics after the fact is often, I mean, we know it's designed for security, that this is well known in computer science, that tacking on these things on the end is a very poor way, right? So for when you're looking at sustainability, has to be built into the drawing board, right? Cradle to grave kind of analysis of sustainability, not thinking after the fact, well, how do I get rid of, you know, all kinds of lead and cadmium in my CRT, right?
After well, that was behind my crypto question, crypto mining question last night. It just seemed bizarre to me that can actually happen, and that people, quote, can make money at it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't let that happen over in the investment banking field, for instance, or even in credit cards. But it's just like, it's free to do it because you've got this clever idea.
The value of a lot of these early startups and these companies is disruption, right? That's their goal, is just disruption and figure out how to monetize it. And that's an irresponsible way to do business. In engineering, there's fiduciary responsibility, there's legal codes and so on. Maybe we need, you know, like in medical kind of practices, you've got this Hippocratic oath. Yeah, maybe we need a Hippocratic oath for computer scientists. Not that, you know, everyone keeps the Hippocratic oath, but I mean the idea that, you know, to kind of build that in, right, is kind of a part of the program, but also part of the responsibility.
It's called an iron ring ceremony.
Yeah, in Canada, I have one in my drawer at home. That kind of idea, you know, where that becomes part of the rite of passage, that there's some kind of recognition that, you know, in the words of Richard Mao, you know, now that, you know, when students have been trained with many new things, they also have more to be faithful with. You know, and what does that look like as Christian? And
I think it's dinner time.
Yeah.
All right.